And then she'll introduce you and...
Hey, how are you?
Absolutely.
PhDs. Okay. So you want me to start? Thank you, Anne-Marie. So, you know, this afternoon I'm just going to go over lung cancer, and mostly what I'm going to talk about is clinical aspects of lung cancer. Okay? So just give you a general overview of how I view lung cancer as a surgeon. And it's important in giving that preface because the way a medical oncologist views lung cancer is a little bit different, and the way a radiation oncologist views lung cancer is a little bit different. And I'll try to cover some aspects of radiation chemotherapy as well, but primarily I'll be giving you an overview of how lung cancer patients present, what do the tumors look like, what we do in terms of surgery, and when chemotherapy and radiation can be useful. I'll touch a little bit on some research opportunities in lung cancer, but we won't go very deeply into that. And just to keep you guys awake, I'll show a video of how lung cancer surgery is done as well. Okay? Okay. Now, since there are only about 20 of you, feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. Okay? At least to wake up your neighbors. So, lung cancer typically presents to a surgeon as either one nodule or more than one nodule. And we keep it that way because as surgeons, we can't deal with anything more complex. Okay? The differential diagnosis when you see a nodule on a CT scan or an X-ray is it can be malignant or benign, pretty much. And benign can be a bunch of different things like infections, granulomas, autoimmune diseases. There are about 40 or 50 conditions that can cause a benign lung nodule. As a surgeon, the moment I think I have to think about something for more than 30 seconds, I send it to the pulmonologist to figure it out so that he can figure it out and send it back to me if I have to operate. Okay? So these are all the conditions. Very well documented in textbooks. Not particularly useful for me because all I care about is if it's benign or malignant. Okay? So when you talk about malignant lung nodules, that's where I care about the second thing. That is it primarily from lung cancer or is it metastatic nodule from another cancer? And that's important for many reasons, right? If it's metastatic nodule from another cancer, then the overall prognosis for the patient is different. And the way I treat it would also be different. There are some situations in which I will take out metastatic lung nodules. That's called a metastasectomy. And there are situations in which I wouldn't touch them. The times when I actually operate on metastatic lung nodules is when the patient satisfies three criteria. One, if the cancer has spread from somewhere else in the body to the lung, the primary tumor should already be treated or controlled. Number two, that the lungs should be the only site of disease. So if someone has metastatic nodules in the lungs, liver, adrenals, then me taking out the lung nodules is not going to help the patient. The third thing is the disease interval, that is the time between the diagnosis of the first primary tumor and the diagnosis of the metastatic nodule should ideally be as far apart as possible. Okay? And add to that a fourth condition, and that's true for all of surgery, is you'd only operate if there are no other better alternatives available. Goes without saying, but it's not that straightforward. So I remember a young patient, I think he was 25 or so, with an osteosarcoma, with lung mets. You know, with lung metastases to osteosarcoma typically doesn't respond to chemotherapy very well. And I took out 52 nodules from one lung for this patient. 52 nodules. Why? Because the disease was nowhere else. The primary was controlled. The patient had a reasonable disease-free interval. And osteosarcoma doesn't respond to chemotherapy. So really, the patient's only choice was lung surgery. Right? So that's all I'm going to tell you about metastatic nodules. Everything else that you're going to hear today is going to be primary lung cancer. When I see a nodule in a patient, my only goal as a surgeon is to rule out or rule in primary lung cancer. Okay? And how do I do that? I take into concert what the patient is, what the background is, what the personal history of the patient is, what the imaging looks like, what the PET scan looks like, and I put all that together to come up with the best guess. And to come up with the best guess, you have to know what's in the next few slides, which is the epidemiology of lung cancer, right? In the United States today, lung cancer is the most common cause of cancer-related death in adults. It is not the most common cancer, but it's the most common cause of cancer-related death. Okay? So, the older you are, the greater the chance of developing lung cancer. It's true of most adult cancers. Exposure to tobacco is an important aspect. Occupational agents, particularly asbestos. So, do you know what the Robbins textbook of pathology is? Right, it's a big tome that scares most second year med school students. But it's a very good textbook of pathology. And I still remember one paragraph that really blew my mind when I read that the first time in med school. If you're a smoker, the risk of developing lung cancer during your lifetime is about 11 times a non-smoker. If you have exposure to asbestos, the risk of developing lung cancer is about 7 times than if you didn't. If you are a smoker and have asbestos exposure, the risk of developing lung cancer is 77 times another person. That's how additive exposures are. And of course, genetics, like anything else, which is what you're here for. Okay. And, you know, with gender, you know, no one's really sure if males or females are more susceptible to lung cancer. The kind of lung cancer in women can be a little bit different than in most men. So there is a particular kind of lung cancer called a lepidic adenocarcinoma, which happens in never-smoking women. It's a very particular kind of lung cancer. And that has other molecular features as well that are different. So this lepidic adenocarcinoma, what was called as BAC or bronchoalveolar lung cancer before, it has, most of those patients have some sort of mutation, like an EGFR mutation or an ALK4 translocation. But it also makes them very susceptible, that cancer very susceptible to response from targeted agents. Okay? Now diet, these are loose associations, and you know, they're all over the place. And of course, COPD, pulmonary fibrosis. Now nobody really quite understands if COPD causes lung cancer or smoking causes both COPD and lung cancer. But one thing is true. The greater your COPD is from smoking, the higher the chances of you developing lung cancer. Okay? So it seems like inflammation from smoking, or from COPD, has some sort of etiological relationship with lung cancer. Okay. That's my daughter. She'll have to wait. Okay. So, Again, this just shows that as you grow older, the chance of a pulmonary nodule being cancer is higher. And again, the more you smoke, the greater the chances of you developing lung cancer. And same thing in a sort of a different format. This is one pack per day, and this is two packs per day. And as you can see, it's more than a linear relationship in terms of your chance of developing lung cancer. So when I see a patient with a nodule, this is what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the clinical history, all the lab work that we do, radiographic evidence. I'm looking at the physiology because I need to know if they can tolerate lung surgery or not, right? And then we'll initiate a diagnostic markup. So when you look at clinical history, these are the things that are important. Symptoms from lung, most patients with lung cancer are asymptomatic, okay? But when they do have symptoms, those symptoms are influenced by location. Sometimes I tell patients that cancer is a little bit like real estate. Location, location, location makes a big difference in prognosis, makes a big difference in how you can resect the tumor or not, and makes a big difference in even how fast it spreads sometimes. The second is extension, because lung cancer can invade structures around the tumor itself. The third is if it's metastasized. Because someone, for example, a patient may come to you with a headache and you get a brain MRI and it shows a lung cancer met. It's a not uncommon way of diagnosing lung cancer. You know, I've had occasional patients who were diagnosed because they had neck pain. And when they had imaging of the neck, the top slice found a tumor sitting right at the base of the neck, invading the vertebral, the cervical vertebral body that's causing the neck pain. A superior sulcus tumor. Okay? Of course, not all of you with neck pain have lung cancer, so don't worry about it. But you know, patients come with those symptoms. And then hormonal symptoms, which are much more common with small cell lung cancer. So these are the most common pulmonary symptoms from lung cancer. Cough, hemoptysis, dyspnea, fever, and chest pain. And except for hemoptysis, these are fairly non-specific, right? Anyone with COPD has cough. They have dyspnea. You know, some they can have fever from infection, and they can have chest pain. Hemoptysis, though, is a worrying sign. Hemoptysis is when people cough up blood, right? Hemoptysis is a worrying sign. Can someone tell me what the most common cause of hemoptysis is in the United States? Guess. There's no wrong answer. Can't hear you. Not in the United States. In China or in India, that was the most common cause. 40 years ago, it was mitral stenosis. But now, in China or India, it's tuberculosis. But here, it's just bronchitis. Chronic bronchitis. You know. Sorry, I need to take this call. It's from my fellow. Give me a second.
Hello? I will. I'm in the middle of the lecture. Can I call you back? Okay.
So, chronic bronchitis. But any patient with hemoptysis, you really have to evaluate very closely for lung cancer, because it's probably the second most common cause of hemoptysis. Okay. Extrapulmonary, pleural effusion, you know, causing dyspnea. If you have a left-sided tumor, you can have a recurrent laryngeal nerve involvement that leads to hoarseness. So I'll show you a picture of a tumor that actually invades the superior vena cava, causing an SVC syndrome. These patients come with bulging eyes, with very distant neck veins, with very prominent nasal, veins in the face, and that's an SVC syndrome. Or you can have dysphagia because of compressing the esophagus. Dysphagia is an inability to eat, right? And all of these, right? Bone pains from bone mets. CNS symptoms like headaches, which is what I was describing before to you. Hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy. This is very rare nowadays. This was a classic symptom or sign of of lung cancer when I was your age. No longer. And of course, just like with any cancer, weight loss and weakness. Some of the hormonal conditions I was talking about, mostly with small cell lung cancer, are all of these, with the exception of hypercalcemia that happens mostly in squamous cell cancer. The proportion of asymptomatic patients has rapidly increased, and I'll tell you why in a little bit. But nowadays, most of my patients who come to me for surgery are asymptomatic. Physical findings, a lot of them are non-specific, to be honest with you. Yeah. This is what hypertrophic osteoarthropathy looks like. In my first year of med school, there are about eight or nine things that cause this, and you have to know them by heart. Nobody sees this anymore. It's almost irrelevant. Okay. Some lab findings, most lab findings are non-specific, and they could be all of these. But none of these diagnostic. There is no diagnostic lab test yet for lung cancer. So when you look at imaging, which is the most important thing for a thoracic surgeon, for us, we only believe the patient exists if there's a CT scan of the patient. You know, we are so reliant on imaging. So the first thing you've got to look at is chest X-ray. And it's very critical that you get old X-rays. Because when you look at a nodule, if it hasn't changed in size for 2 years or so, the chance that it's a lung cancer is close to zero. People can have nodules, but not all nodules are cancer, right? So you want to look at the rate of growth of that nodule on a chest X-ray. CT scan is our clinical workhorse. MRI for rare situations. It's good for the brain. It's good for looking at the brachial plexus. It's good for looking at the spine. Sometimes it's good for looking at the liver. Okay? Bone scans. We stopped using this after the advent of PET scans. And most patients who come to me with lung cancer or a lung nodule end up getting a CT scan and a PET scan to start with. And then we go to other things. But, you know, you can find many things on X-ray. For example, you can see this fullness in the left hilum. That's a tumor. And then, can you see this lesion in the bone? Right? Little lucency. That's a bone met. Okay? And there's another lesion here. I don't think you can see it on the screen. That's actually a metastatic intrapulmonary nodule. Right there. Right? Okay. So this is what a CT scan of a lung cancer patient typically looks like. So have any of you seen CT scans? Okay, so when you look at a CT scan, just imagine that the patient is lying on a table with the feet towards you and the head away from you, and you're sort of slicing the body, right? So this is right, this is left, right? Feet towards you, head away from you. And so this is the chest, this is the trachea that's split into two. This is the right mainstem bronchus, left mainstem bronchus. This is the aorta. This is the proximal part of the aorta, then the aorta makes a loop and comes back. Right into the descending aorta. This is the pulmonary artery. This is the superior vena cava. And see how the tumor can compress the superior vena cava? This is what causes an SVC syndrome. Okay? You see this fluid here? The black thing here, this is the lung. And this is fluid. So this patient has advanced lung cancer. Okay? So these are the most common sites of metastases from lung cancer, just like most of the cancers, honestly. Lymph nodes, other lung lobes, brain, liver, adrenal glands, and bone. Okay. A PET scan is the next scan we tend to get. And it's fairly sensitive and somewhat specific for mediastinal lymph node involvement and involvement of other organs. There are a couple of tumors that don't light up on a PET scan. One is a carcinoid. The other is a BAC. This is important to remember. And of course, if you have any kind of inflammatory lesion, this can be positive. A common inflammatory lesion in Western New York that can mimic lung cancer is sarcoidosis. Very common in this area. So when I see a patient in this area who comes to me with a lung nodule and a mediastinal lymph node that's active on PET, I do not automatically assume he has metastatic disease. We have to biopsy the lymph node to make sure that it has cancer. Okay? Because it could be sarcoid. So the next thing I do after getting the CT scan and the PET scan is I look to see if this patient can have surgery, if there is isolated disease and the disease is suitable for surgery. And in order to do that, I get a spirometry, that's the lung function, I get some arterial blood gases, I get a perfusion scan. And what a perfusion scan is essentially is you send radioactive dye that sits in both lungs, and then you get a scan so that you can see how much blood supply is there in the left lung and the right lung. Occasionally, you'll have a lesion that cuts off the blood supply to the lung, right? And then when you actually get the perfusion scan, that side is not perfused at all. In that situation, you know that the patient already is living without a lung, essentially. So it's perfectly safe to take that lung out, and you will not impact the patient physiologically. So it's that sort of thing that a perfusion scan is useful for. And then an excise. If all of these are sort of borderline, then an exercise pulmonary test is your deal breaker. And that measures how much oxygen a patient can utilize to determine how well you can tolerate surgery. Now, I don't know if you can see this clearly. This is a bronchoscopy, okay? This is the carina. This is the left main stem. This is the right main stem, okay? And this, for example, is a tumor that you can see that's endobronchial. Can you see it? I don't know if it presents well because I can't see it very well here. The next thing I do, once I get all this done, is I stage the tumor. And like all tumors, like all solid tumors, the staging of a lung cancer is dependent upon three things. The size of the tumor. Two, how many lymph nodes and what kind of lymph nodes are involved. And three, if there's metastatic disease or not, that it's spread outside the chest or not. Okay? And clearly, this is a survival curve. And you must have seen survival curves for other systems as well. And so basically, the first curve is for early stage. The last curve is for stage 3A. If you go to stage 4, it looks something like this. Okay. So, the greater the stage, the worse the outcome. And this is how it's measured. So surgical staging, which further refines the stage, is done by a number of different ways. One is mediastinoscopy, then you have a Chamberlain procedure, and then VATS. And this is what a mediastinoscopy looks like. You make a little incision in the neck. You find the windpipe, and you dissect right on top of the windpipe, and then you put the scope down there, and then you biopsy the lymph nodes. Okay? When it goes well, it's a 15-minute thing, and when it doesn't go well, it's terrible, because there are a lot of blood vessels in this area. You know, there's the aorta, there's pulmonary artery, all sorts of things. You can get into all sorts of vessels. Okay? So, but that's useful for staging. And then this is the lymph node map. And as surgeons, we obsess about this because half the surgery is taking out the tumor, and the other half is biopsying all these lymph nodes to stage the tumor. So every lung resection is a staging operation on itself. So this is out of every 100 patients that we see in clinic, 50% are stage 4. 25% are less than stage 4. They're all in the chest, but we can't cure them. Okay? And only 25% are potentially curable. Right? This is out of every 100 patients who walk into the thoracic clinic. It's a terrible number. Okay? The surgical management. In the past, we would do the surgery through big incisions, either postrolateral thoracotomy, anterior thoracotomy, or mean sternotomy. A thoracotomy is a cut through the side. The sternotomy is you divide the sternum in the middle. But nowadays, most of our cases are done with video assistance by VATS. So it's the chest equivalent of laparoscopic surgery. Okay. And surgical resections are typically one of three kinds. Either a lobectomy, so the human being has five lobes, three on the right side, two on the left. Okay? So lobectomy is taking out one of those lobes. Or you can do a larger resection, like taking out two lobes, or a pneumonectomy, which is taking out an entire lung. Right? Or you could do a lesser resection, like a segmentectomy and a wedge resection. There are 10 segments on the right side in the lung and 8 segments on the left side. So that's what a segmentectomy is. Okay? And when we have to operate on lungs, we cannot operate on a lung that's moving with each breath. So we have to isolate the lung and operate on the lung that's not moving. Right? In order to do that, we use something called a double lumen tube, which is actually pretty neat. So the way this is inserted is, this tube has two little tubes within it, and you pass it down into the trachea, and one of the little tubes goes into the left side, and the other is ventilating the right side. And there's a balloon here that is inflated, and there's a balloon here that's inflated. And at the top end of this, it splits into two tubes. So one of the tubes is connecting to the left side, one of the tubes is connecting to the right side. And because of these balloons, both sides are isolated. So once you have the system in place, you can completely isolate ventilation to only one side or the other. And this is what makes modern lung surgery possible. Let's see if this video plays. Okay. So this is a VATS right lower lobectomy. Okay. So just for orientation, this is the head, this is the foot. This is the azygos vein here. This is the spine. This is the right-sided tumor. Okay? This is the bronchus intermedius. This is the airway. And this is the lymph node in the carina. As you can see, that was the carina. So the next step is I take the inferior pulmonary vein. So we go around this with a clamp very carefully because this is connected directly to the heart. If you have a bleeding in any of these vessels, you bleed at the rate of 1 liter a minute. Okay, so that's not good. And this is a stapler. It's a nifty little instrument which can seal a vessel or the lung and divide it at the same time. So here, this is the pulmonary artery going to the lower lobe. So this is the upper lobe here, middle lobe here, lower lobe here. So we very slowly, you know, divide the lung and get exposure to the artery. So this is called the fissure right here. And the fissure is the junction between the upper lobe and the lower lobe. So now I'm coming across the fissure and I pass a leader to sort of retract the lung for me. And the stapler goes in. Once I'm all the way through, we fire the stapler. Now there are two more structures left to divide. After we finish the fissure down below here. This is the fissure here. That's going to be done with another device called the ligature, which seals and cuts at the same time. Now, you can see the pulmonary artery. This is the one end. It's coming out the other end. We pass a red rubber catheter, and using that, we pass the stapler across. We divide this. Then, we divide the bronchus that's going to the lower lobe. Once all of this is done, we put that thing in a bag and take it out. As I said, staging is after surgery. We have taken out the subcranial lymph nodes. This is the right paratracheal lymph node, and that's being taken out now. We test the lung, inflate it, put a chest tube, and we're done. Typically, after surgery like this, patient is in the hospital, you know, a couple of days, and goes home. That particular patient is now, I think, 4 years out and alive. She is 65 years old, and about a year ago or so, She sent me a picture. She had climbed one of the lower foothills of the Himalayas. She was at, I think, at 15,000 feet. And so she took a picture and sent it to me. So for early stage tumors, you can do surgery like that. And, you know, it's pretty nice. Anything that is stage 2 or above requires chemotherapy as part of the treatment at some point in the patient's life. Anything that's stage 3A or above could use radiation as long as it's not stage 4. And then you combine this in various combinations depending on the stage of the disease and the specific location of the disease. Okay? When people say neoadjuvant therapy, that means it's chemotherapy or radiation given before the surgery. Adjuvant therapy is therapy given after surgery, because you'll come across this in papers and that sort of thing. I don't know why people have to make it so complicated, but there you go. Okay. Now, a few things. One of the big advances in lung cancer in the last decade is this concept of lung cancer screening. Just like you have mammography for breast cancer screening, you can screen for lung cancer using a CT scan of the chest. Okay? And what they found is that if you do this for thousands and thousands of patients, you can actually improve lung cancer mortality by about 20%. Why? Because you find these cancers in early stages instead of later stages, and so your cure rate is higher. Okay. This is a big paper. You know, it was very influential. Lung cancer screening is now standard, and more we find patients with smaller tumors because of this. Okay. Okay. One of the great areas of research is when you find a nodule on a CT scan. Sometimes the nodule is too small to be biopsied. So do you just wait for it to get bigger to biopsy it? Or is there some way of figuring out if that nodule is a cancer or not, based on many things? This is one such thing, one such examination. So what these investigators did, and the reason I'm showing this is these are the kind of projects that we hope that you will do as you do more of your research. So researchers here, what they did is they took the right mainstem bronchus, which is uninvolved by cancer on all of these patients, and they biopsy that, and they extract RNA from it and look at RNA expression. And they figured out a way to differentiate benign nodules from malignant nodules. Now, this is far from perfect. I don't know if you've seen this ROC analysis, receiver operative characteristic. And so the area under the ROC curve is sort of a measure of how accurate your test is. And the area under the curve for this is somewhere about 0.8, which is good from a mathematical point of view, but not good enough from a clinical point of view. Right? So there are many such attempts at distinguishing benign nodules from cancerous ones, including some blood-based biomarkers, serum microRNAs, circulating tumor cells. My lab works on serum microRNAs and has worked on that for about 10 years. Okay. As I told you, most early-stage lung cancer patients undergo resection. Despite this, there is a high recurrence rate. So for a stage 1 lung cancer patient, the recurrence rate is about 30%. Right? And studies have shown that if you give all stage 1 lung cancer patients chemotherapy, you actually hurt more patients than you help. So you can give chemotherapy to all stage 1 lung cancer patients. So, you know, people have tried to figure out which of these patients are more likely to recur so that you can give them chemotherapy. And one such study is this. It's a 46 gene signature for adenocarcinoma recurrence. But this is another research. This hasn't been validated clinically. We don't use it now on a regular basis. But this is the kind of research project that someone can do. You know, it's a prognostic classifier. The other area that's really taken off is looking at mutations in lung cancer, right? Actionable mutations in lung cancer. The big success story in this field is EGFR mutations and using anti-EGFR agents for it. Then there's ALK, crizotinib. Big deal for these patients. This has really changed the way we treat these patients. And more, you know, this is an old slide, more and more you'll see that the proportion of patients with actionable mutations is increasing every year. Okay. And so adenocarcinomas are the carcinomas that have the highest proportion of actionable mutations. KRAS is very common, but unfortunately it's not actionable yet. But you have others that are actionable. There's a whole project, there's a whole new explosion of actionable mutations in squamous cell cancer. That's going to be the next big step in lung cancer. Now, immunotherapy. For those of you who are budding immunologists, you're doing this at the right time. Okay. This is sort of the biggest explosion in medical oncology, the lung cancer side. Okay. So the biggest advance has been in checkpoint inhibitors. And then there are increasingly more of these are going to be used. Adoptive T-cell therapy is one such thing that I think that's very exciting, a lot of potential. A lot of potential side effects too, but a lot of potential. So PD-L1, you know, anti-PD-L1 agents, PD-L1 blockade agents are now very commonly used. And so, you know, there are two predictors of response to PD-L1. And one of them is just the amount of PD-L1 in a tumor, and the second is the amount of mutational burden. And this is a third kind of research project you can do, which is determining sensitivity of patients to particular agents. So chemo or radiation sensitivity or response prediction, right? That's another kind of research project you could do. So here I'll stop and I'll take some questions. You know, I think lung cancer, even in 2018, is a terrible cancer to have, despite all the advances we've made. And I think it's a fertile area for research for any of you in the future. Questions? It's just too late in the day. Okay. Let me see if I can email this to you right now.
Yeah, that'd be perfect, because I'll post that on the website then.
What's your email, please?
J-E-N-A dot W-A-L C-Z Y-K at Roswell Park.
I may have to take out the video. I think.
Might be too big to send.
Yeah. Let me see.